Accession number 27347, Reel 10.
Stanley Brown, Reel 10. Stanley, you just described to me off the tape the importance of the wind and how that works with an aircraft.
Well, whilst you're on the ground, you're part of the earthy world. As soon as your wheels leave the ground, in other words, as soon as you're becoming part of the air, well, you are part of the air, which is so very different to being on the ground. When you're ground-born, you point along a runway and you go along the runway. But the instant you become unstuck and become part of the air, if the air is not flowing straight down the runway, you're not travelling straight down the runway. If the wind is coming from your right-hand side, you'll find that you drift. As soon as your wheels come unstuck from the ground, the aeroplane starts travelling sideways. You're no longer you're no longer tracking down the runway or parallel to the runway. You're moving sideways. So you've got to slew round and point to the right if the wind's coming. Point into the wind. And then you will still be travelling along the runway, even though you're not pointing along the runway. You're crabbing down the runway because this is drift. The air is taking you sideways relative to the runway. The thing that a novice pilot has to remember is that as soon as he becomes unstuck from the ground, as soon as he's got the lift, he's got to correct the direction in which his aircraft is pointing if the wind is anything other than from straight ahead. He has to point into the wind, but he'll still be travelling crab-wise. Does that...
So the wind is... would you say the wind is the most important thing to master, really, while when you're learning to fly in the early stages? Is it one of the main factors for consideration, or the main factor?
It's one of the main factors in landing, because if you're pointing down a runway, but you're crabbing down the runway, obviously the stress on your undercarriage is very great the minute the wheels touch the ground. If the wind is too much, if it's too strong and differing from the runway to a very great degree, depending on your speed, you could be almost 45 degrees travelling at 45 degrees to the angle of the runway, which means a certain undercarriage failure. You have to learn to kick the rudder at the very last minute to bring your nose in line with the runway to reduce the stress on your undercarriage. Ground loops and undercarriage failure are the result of not coping with a variation in the wind direction from the runway.
What would happen with a ground loop? What does the aircraft do?
Because the aircraft is crabbing, the minute the wheels touch the ground, there's a sideways thrust on the wheel, so it can spin round, not quite like a top, but it can do a 180 degree turn, and it can end up off the runway if he was going down the centre of the runway, he's likely to end up in the mire, off the runway, on the opposite side of the runway to the direction of the wind.
Now, you mentioned, obviously, one of the other things was stalling. How easy was it to stall something like the Tiger Moth? Did it have a very low stall speed?
Yes, it had a very low stalling speed, round about 45 knots. And the one wing always stalls before the other one in that type of aircraft, or in that design of aircraft, I should say. I'm qualifying that because with the Swordfish, both wings stalled at the same time. You could never make one differ from the other, so you couldn't spin a Swordfish. She just mushed through the air. But with a Tiger Moth, one wing would stall before the other, so that when that wing stalled, there was lift on the other wing, it would flick up and over, and because there was no lift on the other wing, it would drop down and you'd go into a vertical spin.
Now, obviously, that was one of the things that you were taught to get out of by your instructor.
Yes.
How were you instructed in spinning?
By doing it. He'd put it in the spin and he'd say, now to get out of this, which way are you turning? Turning right. Put the stick forward, opposite rudder, and then gradually bring it out by putting on opposite rudder. You yaw the plane round and make the stalled wing gain speed so that it recovers lift, and then you gradually bring the stick back to come out of the dive.
Now, to somebody who's never flown an aircraft, spinning looks a terrifying type of thing. How did you take to it initially when you moved to...
Oh, we were scared stiff of it because of torque. And it wasn't uncommon for somebody in their early days of training to be so concentrating on the approach and looking for other aircraft to stall on the approach and spin in and kill themselves. So that it was an example to all the rest of us, but we were a bit chary of it, a bit scared about it. And it wasn't until the instructor put us through the paces and we knew that the method was infallible, our confidence recovered. We were mad keen to do it and show that we could do it, and then we were masters of it. It was such a boost to our confidence, and we knew that that was the next step towards going solo.
With that as well, is it a natural action to push the stick forward, would you say?
No, the natural action is to pull the stick backwards to pull it out of this horrible dive with the world going round in front of you. The instinct would be to pull back, but if you do, you just stalled the wing further. You disrupted the airflow over the second wing as well as the first. By putting on opposite rudder, if you were spinning to the right, putting on opposite rudder to the left, made your right wing gain speed and hence get lift again.
And how quickly would the Tiger Moth come out of a spin?
Oh, it was just a matter of a few seconds, 20 seconds, 25 seconds, something like that. But you lost a lot of height in that time. It was never safe to do a spin in less than 3,000 feet. This allowed you plenty of time to recover and avoid getting in anybody else's way below 1,000 feet.
I was going to ask, actually, what heights were you kind of operating at while you were training?
A lot of the training would be at 2,000 feet, depending on the cloud base. It was generally just under the cloud base, but on a clear, bright day where there's a lot of cumulus cloud and no base to keep us down, it'd be about 2,000 feet. And from this height, you could, on an engine failure, you could glide to a field that was suitable for landing in British countryside.
One of the things that you mentioned as well was obviously doing turns. Is there a potential problem of stalling in a turn?
There is. If there's a potential stalling in any manoeuvre, if you're clumsy, if you alter the angle of attack of the wing too suddenly, like pulling out of a dive, trying to do it too steeply, you can mush, stall the wing and go into a spin. Any distraction, any lack of attention, which allows either your engine revs to reduce or your nose to come up, is a potential stall.
Now, you mentioned with this that obviously the countryside you would be looking. Was it instilled into you to look for?
Oh, yes. Always to know where your landing was going to be if the engine cut. And of course, the favourite thing was for the instructor suddenly to haul back on the throttle, take it out of your hand, and he'd hold it back with the engine just ticking over, and he'd say, "Now, where you're going to go, what you're going to do now?" And you'd have to say, "Oh, I'm going for that field." And he said, "Don't be a bloody fool. Can't you see the electric pylons going across it? Or can't you see that oak tree at the far end?" He'd say, "Choose another one." And that was difficult when you were actually gliding down. It was too late, really. You could, in emergency, change your mind at the last minute. But it could be fatal.
What kind of distance would you need in a field to land in with a tiger moth?
With the tiger, it depends on the wind, of course. The wind controls your speed. If your stalling speed is 45, and there's a, that means you've got to keep your speed above 45. If the wind is 45 knots, then you're only covering the ground at one or two knots, and you can practically helicopter down into a field. You could choose almost any field you want. But normally, if there was no wind, and you were coming into land at 50 knots, a field of about 200 yards would do, providing there weren't any high hedges or trees on the near side of the field or the far side of the field. You always had to think of how you were going to get it out again once it's restarted the engine.
Was there a lot of emphasis on this potential that you might have to force land?
Not enough to frighten us. It was an awareness rather than a threat. And it was something to be overcome rather than be so frightened that you'd give up. No, the instructors were excellent at judging how far to warn you of a problem without making you scared.
Now, you mentioned earlier that this was a course of repetition, really, of the same activity.
Yes.
You're so familiarised with
it. Yes.
I think. With your growing confidence, how happy were you feeling in this initial stage of your training about your flying abilities?
Oh, we were mad keen, because if you had confidence in your instructor, if he didn't bully you, if you formed a rapport with your instructor, you were mad keen to show him how well you could do things. We wanted to show the rest of the course that we were going to get through. There was an esprit de corps right from the start, a spirit of wanting to master this new skill and enjoying it. It's rather like a youngster today learning to ride a motorbike. To do it safely, without risk, falls a bit flat at times. The ones that succumb to showing off are the ones that don't survive.
Obviously, as well, at that stage, there must have been some people, because you mentioned that the instructors could usually tell within 3 or 4 hours of who would make a pilot.
Yes.
There must have been some people who just couldn't get the hang of...
Oh, there were people who had no coordination, could never judge the height of the aircraft above the ground when coming into land. Just the same as some people can never learn how to park the car between two other cars that are close together. But there's a technique. If only you listen and learn, the finesse of doing things depends on how keen you are and how much of a rapport you've made with your instructor for him to want to pass on to you and to see that you're doing it properly.
And who were these instructors? Where did they come from?
Very few of them were time expired people who'd done their quota of bombing trips. They were generally people who had excelled at their flying school and never got to ops, never got beyond the training aircraft that they were training people on. Sorry, that's not true. After getting wings, the instructors on the big planes like Lancs and so on, to go back to a Tiger Moth was almost demotion and ruined their morale. And very often they didn't want to be instructors. But if they got as far as their wings and excelled at it, they were likely to become instructors. I can give an example. In my logbook, at my wings, that's my assessment. When I got my wings as a single engine pilot, above the average. As pilot navigator, above the average. In bombing, above the average. In air gunnery, above the average. Has he shown special aptitude as a pilot navigator? Yes.
So would this be at the stage then, potentially, where
they want me to become an instructor?
Yeah.
Yes.
Because within by 1943, you mentioned that obviously demotion of some people who've been on operational squadrons flying the heavy bombers or whatever, or fighters would find it difficult to return to that. So were you getting more of those pilots coming through who were...
You were getting a lot of them through because there were a lot of them finishing their schedule of operations. For some of them, it was a terrific relief, naturally. For some of them, it was a landmark, and it was a breather between going and doing another session of ops. With some, it was a case of, right, I've done my bit. I'm glad to spend time showing the next generation of youngsters how to go along with it.
With the people who were not making the grade, what happened to them?
They disappeared after being told that they were failed. They were moved out within minutes, literally. They never mixed with us as failed pilots, and we never really learned what was happening to them because they just disappeared. There were no farewells, there were no handshakes. They packed their gear and went. It was a way of keeping morale up. A man who was on the way out could be very gloomy and depressing, and it was best that didn't rub off on anybody else.
And prior to actually soloing, would you have had ground instruction as well in this early part?
Oh, yes. At Sealand, we spent alternate mornings and afternoons. One morning we'd be flying and ground subjects in the afternoon, and the next day we'd swap. So that the ground instruction instructors only had half the course at any one given time, and the flying instructors only had half the course at any one given time. It was a way of giving us information at a time when we had a chance to apply it in practice. Map reading, for instance, we'd have an instruction in the morning, and that afternoon, whilst we're away, we could have a look at our map and relate the things that we'd learned in ground subjects.
What other types of things would you do in the ground subject?
Naval procedures, link trainer, armaments, types of explosives used in different bombs, and why. Type of explosive used in torpedoes and why it was different to a bomb. We learned a bit more about internal combustion engines. It was no longer just suck, push, bang, blow. We learned something about timing, advancing and retarding, about mixture, the effect that leaning it out would have. We learned a lot more about meteorology, and we could relate it to the things we were doing in the flying sessions. So it was a lovely practical come theoretical experience, rather like my life in chemistry, where I'd do the theoretical and then practical every afternoon. an essential part. There's a balance between the two.
But obviously you would have to keep up with your ground work.
Oh,
as
yes.
As you're flying. Again.
Yes, and if you fell behind in any of your exams, that could fail you just as exactly as failing a flying test could.
Now, obviously, you got to this stage of soloing.
Yeah.
Which is, I suppose, for every pilot, the most exciting thing. What was the process of soloing? What would happen?
Well, I knew it was coming up because I'd gone through so many of the routine flights with an instructor where we'd covered every aspect time after time after time. Mind, we're talking about spinning started at 5 hours. We were condemned if we didn't go solo by 12 hours. We were expected, if we were going to be anything like a pilot, to go solo around about 8 hours. It's not a lot when you think of today's driving school lessons, where 15, 20 lessons each of an hour, quite common. No, it wasn't. Considering that most of us had never driven a car, because we came from a strata of society, the grammar school, where parents didn't have a car. So the boys who really excelled, there was one in particular who was the son of a haulage contractor who'd driven cars from the day he was knee-high to the hubcaps. He just took to flying as if it was a racing car, which is understandable, because it's really coordination of your senses to adjust what you see with what you do and how quickly you do it and how you do the right action. That's all it is. Flying and driving a car, much the same, or learning to drive a car, but we had to do it in much less time. There was an urgency.
So what would happen on the day that you soloed?
We went round and did the ordinary routine practices, spinning, recovery from a spin, and then a glide approach and landing. In fact, on my day when I went solo, the instructor cut the engine when I was on the downwind leg of the circuit to see whether I could get in without going through the normal routine, and I did. And after touching down, he said, right, go on into the crew hut. And I taxied in. He got out and he said, stay where you are. And I knew then that this was my chance. He tapped me on the shoulder and he said, good luck, although you won't need it. And she's all yours.